When we establish a quorum, Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Berryhill.
Here.
Berryhill here. Leyva.
Here.
Leyva here. Mitchell.
Here.
Mitchell here. Canella. DeLeon.
Here.
DeLeon here.
We establish a quorum. Ms. Mitchell, as well as Mr. Berryhill and Ms. Leyva, good afternoon to each and every one of you. Why don't we go to bill referrals, file item number one. Can we establish a motion? We have a motion made by Ms. Leyva. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Mitchell.
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Canella. DeLeon.
Aye.
DeLeon, aye.
Motion passes in a 4-0 vote. We're going to go to file items number 3 through 7. 3 through 7. Madam Secretary, please call the roll. Oh, I apologize. I got ahead of myself. We have a motion made by Ms. Leyva. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Mitchell.
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Canella. DeLeon.
Aye.
DeLeon, aye.
Motion passes on a 4-0 vote. We have cleared out most of our calendar. We just have one file item, which is file item number 2. And that is the governor's appointee, Undersecretary, Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. I hope I pronounce this correctly. It is Mr. Kenneth Pogue.
Perfect.
Kenneth mm-hmm. Pogue. Kenneth Pogue. To the honorable and the incredible Nettie, welcome back to home. You know, and we miss you. If you if you want to come up and you know. If you want to come up and assume your old you know, position, please feel free. You know, we have a plaque here we're going to put behind one of the chairs.
You give all the old people.
Yeah. I'm sure we're going to behave too. Well, that's the reason why when Nettie comes up here, something's about to happen or they think something's going to happen, you know. So with that, Mr. Pogue, welcome. If there's any loved ones that you have, friends, family, please feel free to introduce them. Why don't you give us a statement about yourself, and then we'll go to questions and answers from the members.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Mr. Pro Tem, senators. Thank you for the opportunity to appear here before you, and we really appreciate your interest in the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. I'd also like to thank the governor for his support in appointing me to this position, as well as his overarching support for the corrections department as a whole. I have two families here today that I'd like to acknowledge. First, my coworkers from CDCR who have both welcomed me and supported me since I've been at Corrections.
Thank you.
And specifically, I'd like to thank Scott Kernan for coming out of retirement to provide leadership to the department in a time where we really need him. So thank you, Scott, for being here. And then, most importantly to me, obviously, my family. My parents, Joyce and Gary. My wife, Jennifer Cutler. My sons, by order of age, Liam, stand up. No blushing, Finn. Finnegan. Oh, there it goes. Kellen. And,
so just so it's on the record, just to be correct, you are an Irish family, right?
That is correct.
I couldn't tell.
But my family is very important to me, and without their support, I couldn't do this very difficult job. So I can't even say how important it is to me to have them here today. So thank you. And finally, you know, since I've been at Corrections for 4 years, I've really become a believer in what we do. It's an important role that I'm filling, and it's one that I'm fully committed to. And so if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. We'll start with questions or commentaries from the members. Ms. Leyva?
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. Good afternoon, Mr. Pogue.
Good afternoon.
I apologize that my schedule didn't allow us to meet before today. I just have a couple questions. I have two prisons in my district, and I have become more familiar with them since I've been elected than I probably thought I would. Take time to thank Scott Kernan for visiting with me. We had a good visit at the women's prison a number of months ago. So my questions are going to focus on the correctional officers. And suicide rates among COs are on the rise, and it's rather alarming. There have been 3 just since April of this year. The suicide rate among COs is the highest of all law enforcement. What role does the warden have in promoting the morale and mental health awareness, and what can you do to help with this situation?
Certainly. Well, specifically, the wardens are there for the day-to-day support of their staff, and but they're not alone. We have a very robust employee health and wellness group that includes a peer support part of the organization. We have 1,100 peer support folks that are trained on outreach and trained to help our employees when they're in difficult times. And then specifically, we have a group of those peer support employees that have been trained through what's the acronym is the ASSIST program, which is a nationally recognized suicide awareness program where they're trained to deal with folks in crisis and how to get them the help they need. But I echo your concern. I've seen those numbers increase. We've got we've got a fairly large number in a short period of time this year after a drop-off, and we're taking that very seriously. The secretary and all of his staff have discussed this, and we're looking at increasing the support that we have. In addition to the peer support, we have a veteran support group that we have out there, and we're providing more training starting at the academy. We have a component of the academy, and we carry that training through to supervisors, and hopefully that we're going to be successful in addressing that, but it's something of great concern to us.
And is there anything that you or the department that can point to that has increased the suicides? I just think that if we find the root of the problem, maybe it's easier to fix the problem, because three in the last month is very shocking.
Yeah, and two, you know, one day after the other. And, you know, the first thing you look is to see if there's anything that is similar between the two, and have not found a similarity between those yet, but we are looking and we're doing statistical analysis to see if there's something we can find. But you're absolutely right. The more that we can do to pinpoint the cause, the better we can address it.
Okay, thank you. How can you ensure that all correctional officers are treated fairly when it comes to disciplinary actions? Specifically, we've received a few letters in the last month at our district office regarding the Chino Men's Prison and knives. My understanding is the rule is you cannot carry a knife, the correctional officers. However, the number of them do. They feel that it's part of their job to help cut someone down if there's a problem or whatnot. Some folks that are found with knives are disciplined different than other folks. So how do we make sure that the correctional officers are being disciplined the same across the board? And what we're told, the allegation is that it's racial, that it's people are treated differently depending on their racial background.
Okay, well, we take those type of allegations very seriously, and what I'd offer to you is any specificity you have, if you haven't already shared it with us, you can share that with me directly. I have access to our EAPT employment attorneys, as well as our internal affairs organization, which is under my chain of command. But to answer your question, our internal procedures and policies, as well as Title 15, are very clear. They build a box. Now, there's some discretion within that box. But the charges and the rules should apply equally. There's some variation in between there because there's obviously mitigating and aggravating circumstances that you would look at, but we are not in any way tolerant of race-based decisions, and if we see that, we'll investigate it and we'll take action. So I urge you through your staff to reach out to me, and I'll take a look at that.
Thank you very much. We will do that. We'll get you the copies of the letters that we have received. Happy to do that. Thank you for your answers today.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Mitchell, do you have questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice Chair. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
To my understanding, within CDCR, there are three undersecretary positions. You filling the role of Undersecretary of Administration and Offender Services, which means that you oversee support services, facility planning and construction management, and information technology.
As well as labor, internal affairs, and research.
Say that one more time.
As I oversee the labor negotiations and internal affairs and research.
Got it. I'm glad I...
And that's enough.
That's more than enough. Yeah, let's be clear. So let me just talk about my reality as a budget committee member before I lead into my question. So the governor's budget proposes a total of about $10.5 billion to operate CDCR in the 16-17 budget year, mostly, of course, from general fund. This amount reflects an increase of about $145 million, a 1% increase, from the revised 15-16 level of funding. We are clear that this level of support, this funding supports approximately 54,000 personnel years, an increase of 578 personnel years over the enacted 15-16 budget. And what my colleagues and I find, continue to struggle with, quite frankly, in the legislature, with those numbers I just shared with you, is on a very sophomoric level. In our mind, population's decreasing, and therefore the budget should decrease. We're clear that's not what's happening.
Correct.
And so I'm glad that labor is now within your purview, because maybe you can answer from both the labor perspective as well as the facilities. I was going to focus on facilities, but we can talk about both.
Certainly.
What would you say are the primary cost drivers that have affected the consistent increase in CDCR's budget, particularly in recent years? And what do you forecast that we can expect will be the CDCR budget in future years?
Well, just from a base standpoint, until we show a durable solution to the court and we run our own business, I don't suspect that we're going to see those numbers decrease, as much as I'd like that as well.
The foreseeable future?
Well, and that becomes the question. You have some things that we've implemented through the three-judge court mm-hmm. that have lowered population. You've seen Prop 47, a lot of other initiatives that have lowered our numbers. But at this point, our numbers have leveled out and look to actually be very slowly increasing to the point where by 2020, we expect we'll be right about that level of 137.5 that the court has held us to. So until something is done in the way of a durable final solution that brings those numbers down permanently, I don't think you're going to see a huge reduction in our budget. But to answer the rest of your question, the main drivers are, as you've identified, employee costs. You know, we have increases in wages and we have outstanding balances, you know, leave balances that we have to pay when people retire. We've constructed two infill projects, one at Mule Creek, one in San Diego at RJD. Mule Creek's come online, RJD comes online later this summer. Mm-hmm. Those have been expensive. We had the new healthcare facility in Stockton that was very expensive, mm-hmm. but that was required by the court to meet constitutional
Absolutely.
Care needs.
Because right. we had fallen short for decades.
Yeah, there's a reason for it. And
Absolutely.
Then there's continually an increased expectation that we provide more services mm-hmm. and training and treatment mm-hmm. To our inmates appropriately, I think.
Appropriately.
If we're gonna be successful in lowering the recidivism rate, which will eventually hopefully lower costs, mm-hmm. we have to do these things. So mm-hmm. to answer your question, I don't have a crystal ball, but what I'm hoping is that we find a way to stabilize our population, provide appropriate services, and then see the cost savings as a result of that.
I really appreciate your answer, because that's not the kind of conversation we as a legislature, I think, are having often enough. There continues to be an expectation, and every January my colleagues and I are aghast at the CDCR budget, because I think we have this mythical idea that the budget is going to decrease significantly. And so it's very helpful for me to hear you say that basically is not an appropriate expectation. And so we need to move on from that.
I wouldn't put it that way.
I will, because I'm tired of having the same conversation over and over again when we get stuck in that. And I think it's probably helpful for us to engage more directly with the department, so we are clear about what the triggers are that will ultimately get us there. That's very helpful. That's all I have.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Your honest answer.
Okay, Ms. Mitchell, thank you very much. Mr. Berryhill.
Yeah, I'll be brief. Most of my questions have been answered. But again, I thank you for coming into my office the other day. We had a good conversation. I look forward to going out to Mule Creek and taking a look at that facility. What is the status of Mule Creek, and when will it be open and operational?
So Mule Creek is open. We have two parts of Mule Creek. Each is about 794 is the capacity there. It's open. We are slowly bringing inmates in as we have available health care. So the big limitation is, as it always is hiring healthcare out there. Doctors are hard to find, and I know that the receiver is working very hard to recruit those individuals so that we have constitutional healthcare to provide for them as we bring them out there. But it's open. RJD, the contractor tells us August. I'm suspicious of that. I think it may be a month behind that, but it's looking like August or September it will be open, and that's another 792 beds, 94 beds.
Yeah, how long do you think, I mean, I guess in the perfect world, we wouldn't have a receiver. But how far off are we before we get to that point, do you think?
We've already had three facilities turned over to us. I know the intent is to continue with that process. Hopefully, in the next couple of years, they'll turn those over, and I think the receiver is working towards that goal. But we need to work collaboratively, and we do. The receiver and his staff sit on our cabinet, and we collaborate regularly, and we work together. So I think that process is going very well, but I couldn't tell you the exact date when that would happen.
Yeah, that's been part of the expense factor, I think, over the years. Just to follow up on Senator Mitchell's questioning, what process have you established to identify emerging cost drivers that could increase CDCR's budget? Well, what are we looking at in the future here?
Certainly. Until not too long ago, we had a system where the numbers from our facilities and our costs trailed by months and up to a year. We have a new availability control program that we've implemented that gives us a more real-time idea of what our budgets are, so we forecast better, so that we do a better job of determining what each facility should have in the way of a budget. I've yet to see anyone in state government who's given money that wants to give it back, so we're better off identifying the appropriate costs on the front end so that we don't give that money. And we've been very successful with that program.
Great. Thank you. No more questions.
Thank you much, Senator Berryhill. Mr. Pogue, I think about 70%, it's projected, of the leadership is going to retire within the next 10 years. So you're going to have a massive brain drain. And what are you guys doing right now with regards to workforce development and training and just keeping the institutional knowledge there with CDCR?
Yeah, that's a good question. We certainly don't want to be relying on retired annuitants to keep us going. Sure. So what we're doing is we're expanding our training opportunities. The goal is to identify our leaders earlier and to do a better job of nurturing them. So we're working with Chico and Sac State to identify training programs for low-level management all the way to the top that will identify those folks, and then we can hopefully provide them peer support. But for many years, as you all know, one of the first things to go when the budget is bad is training. Mm-hmm. And so we're playing catch up. But we have a program together, and we're working very diligently to put together training that will help us identify those folks.
Okay. Let's see, Ms. Mitchell, Mr. Berryhill, Ms. Leyva, do you have any other follow-up questions? Seeing none? Okay. Why don't we get those who are in support of Mr. Pogue? Those who are in support of Mr. Pogue, please come on up. I don't know if we'll have the brother-sister tandem.
Darby Kernan with the California State Association of Counties. I've worked with Ken in many different ways, and he's a great partner both at the state and local level, so we support him.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other folks in support? Those in opposition? Do we have Mr. Pogue's mother-in-law here?
Thank you for that.
Okay, we have no one in opposition right now. Okay, so Mr. Pogue, we thank you very much for your answers today of the members, Ms. Mitchell, Ms. Leyva, Mr. Berryhill as well. We will wait. The day of reckoning will be when Mr. Kernan comes, so we'll have a longer, much longer, comprehensive discussion. When that comes up sometime in the future. So with that, can I have a motion? We have a motion made by Ms. Leyva. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Mitchell.
Aye.
Mitchell, aye. Canella. De Leon.
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Mr. Pogue, as well as family, congratulations.
Thank you.
Colleagues, this Senate Rules Committee meeting is adjourned.